Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted, the podcast for those who are done performing, done people pleasing, and done living life on autopilot. I'm your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and this is where we create disruptive, unapologetic transformations for those who are ready to exit survival mode and reclaim their power. Every episode is your permission slip to burn the rule book, break the cycle, and finally build a life that feels like yours. So let's disrupt everything that's holding you back and start living life on your own terms. This is your trigger warning. This podcast is raw. It is real, and it doesn't sugarcoat what it means to survive trauma, abuse, mental health battles, or even the aftermath of living in survival mode for too damn long. What you hear on Survival Mode Disrupted includes unfiltered stories, graphic details, and a vulnerable truth that may trigger some of the audience. Please prioritize your emotional safety. If something feels too heavy, pause. Breathe. Come back when you're ready or not at all. Your healing is yours to honor. These episodes are based on lived experience, not therapy sessions or clinical advice. Listening does not replace mental health treatment or constitute a coach-client relationship. If you're in crisis, please seek immediate help from a licensed professional or contact your local emergency services. This space is built with care, but it's also built for truth and built for disruption. Take what you need, leave the rest, and most of all, trust yourself. If this podcast speaks to your soul, you don't have to do this work alone. Feel free to join our free Facebook community for high-achieving women ready to break cycles and heal out loud. Join us at Disrupting Survival Mode on Facebook. Or grab the book that started this movement, Exiting Survival Mode, a raw step-by-step guide to help you identify, release, and rebuild from the survival patterns that have been keeping you stuck. Hello, 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 and welcome back to another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted. I am your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and today we have Candice with us. Candice, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure, thank you so much, Leticia. So first of all, I am a licensed hypnotherapist and relationship strategist or relationship coach, and I serve high-achieving women who are tired of dating below their level. And through my signature method, I call it the devotion protocol, I recalibrate patterns so that we can attract emotionally available partners who are ready to meet our depth, right? And so the result is that they stop settling and start experiencing real love. That's what I do. And, you know, my story, what's interesting about the fact that we have connected and just met is that I'm so used to telling my story as sort of a marketing content so people understand that I come from what I speak of. But it is very vulnerable for me to be in a place where I'm just honestly just telling my story. And I say that to say that there, you know, even though I'm used to being on podcasts and I have my own podcast, right now there's like a level of nervous anxiety because I'm not used to having to offer as much of my own vulnerability when it comes to being guests on a show or anything like that. But I'm excited to do it. Excited.
Let's first address that. And I just, I appreciate the fact that you are offering up this vulnerability to share your story. I really appreciate that. I really do. And I understand how nervous it can be, particularly when you're in a space of authority and now peeling back those layers of what's really happening below the surface, or what has happened below the surface. So before we get started with your story, I want to ask you, how do you define survival mode?
So I define survival mode as that place that we are when we don't realize our worth. Right?
Very.
When we don't, right? When we don't feel
Yeah.
like how valuable we are, everything feels like we're surviving it.
I love that definition.
Yeah.
So tell us your story to and through
All
survival mode. Were
right.
you, as according to your definition, I'm gonna assume you found your worth.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm continuing to find it because I don't think it's something that, we're not light switches where it's like, oh, I found it and I'm, worthy and 100% I never have a problem. Absolutely not. But I'm definitely like further on that journey, much further than when I started, though. Yeah.
Okay, so let's dig right in.
All right. So, the origin story, right? So I started out basic middle class family. I have parents who were working class, and I always say the mid-level dysfunction, right? We didn't have things like food insecurity, and no one was committing crimes, or there wasn't a heavy load of abuse, but what there was emotional abandonment and a lot of criticism and derision, and the fact that my parents actually didn't get along very well. They stayed together for a very long time, but really had a lot of animosity towards each other, and how that showed up for us as children. And so I come from a family where that is what women do. They get in these long marriages and they endure. And no one's happy. There's like a low-level miserable treatment. It's not out and out and covert. It's just a very just a low-lying default of abuse, unhappiness, misery. And that's what I came from. That's what was modeled for me as far as relationships were as I was growing up. And there was an internal conflict because I was an affectionate child and I was a child that wanted a lot of connection, and that wasn't what was offered. And I got, into romance novels, and I fantasized love and I romanticized everything. And so, that was where I started. And when I went to college, I met what I thought was the love of my life. And I thought that we were going to stay together forever. And we did end up staying together for a little over a decade. And we had a very, I would say, volatile relationship, but also very loving. Like we supported and cared for each other. But when we would fight, we would fight. And that when that relationship ended, I realized at that time that there was a part of me, in going back to my childhood, where I decided at some point that being married and doing that long-term marriage thing wasn't going to be for me. But there was also a part of me that felt like I had to follow the rules. And that's how I ended up in that relationship. And I remember there was one time that my father really gave me a very violent beating for something that, like a low grade or something like that. I don't think, in hindsight, I don't think it had anything to do with me. But at that time, I was probably about 12 or 13 years old. And I remember deciding for myself that being in some long marriage, having a traditional family, all of that stuff was not for me. I knew that I was entitled to other things. And I wanted to make a distinction between entitled and worthy, because that's going to be a big crux of the story. I knew that I was entitled to having an education. I knew that I was entitled to creating a career. I knew that I was entitled to, what was modeled for me, which was enduring a marriage. But I decided I did not want that. So I once that relationship, that long-term relationship broke down, I started just focusing on my career. And I deprioritized love. I put that aside. And I really concentrated on how I could be successful in my career. And I was able to do that. Like as a young woman, I moved to New York City. I, built up a career in entertainment and television. And as I left that long-term relationship and deprioritizing love, it was just, casual relationships and, here and there, didn't really care, was just, I was going to be, at the top of my career. I ended up becoming the art director of the Wendy Williams Show. I don't know if you remember the Wendy Williams Show. Yeah, and that was like the pinnacle of my career because I'd worked up to that. I was working in daytime television. I had everything. I thought I had everything because that's what I thought was going to be my ministry, was being this high achieving career girl. And so, I was at that job. I didn't realize during all of that time that I had deprioritized my love life and I had put that part of me aside. But what I had really put aside was the ability to really partner and connect and have something intimate with another person. So while I was achieving and doing all this stuff and making my career happen and trying to, be as big as I could be, what I had lost was the ability to really connect and understand myself and have peace and not be stressed out all of the time. And so what happened was it started to show up at the job and I got fired from the job. Like after, I think it was two seasons in the pilot, I got fired. And so for me, because that was everything, it was all that I had because I had deprioritized all that other stuff. That was all I had. So I had to go back to this fancy apartment that I could no longer afford because I was fired, to my little 6-pound Pomeranian and probably a bottle of vodka in the freezer, and try to figure out, what do I do now? So here's where the story gets a little crazy, because at 40 years old, I ended up in a very violent, volatile relationship. Because what I did when I was fired, what I told myself, was that it, because the career thing didn't work out, I desperately have to figure out what makes me valuable as a woman. And so what are we told by the patriarchy? What makes you valuable as a woman is when you're married, you're somebody's wife, and you're somebody's mother. So at 40 years old, I found myself in this crisis of I have to make this happen, right? And so what that set me up for is, first of all, a relationship with an ex-con who had a violent past with women, short term, what he wasn't able to even sustain. So moving on to the next. Then I cougared after this guy who was younger than me, who had no, real concrete future plans, who I ended up being a victim of sexual assault with him. So it was consensual, the sex itself, but the assault was not, like the violence was not. And so I sort of was in this abyss of like just not knowing what to do with myself, but feeling such desperation. Ended up meeting someone on Plenty of Fish. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's a dating app, and it's one of the worst ones. I always say it's like, in New York at that time, you could get on the subway for like $2.25. Plenty of Fish was free. It was just like not a really good vetting. There was no good standards for who could be on there. So you would meet anybody. And so it was just like meeting somebody on the subway. Like I could have just met this person on the subway platform and not had any sort of understanding of where they were coming from, who they were. And I ended up going out with him. And so because I was in such a mindset of desperation, I found that I really allowed a lot of things into my life through this person that otherwise, if I understood my value, not just a sense of entitlement, I would have never allowed. So we ended up sort of a rocky beginning. I ignored all the red flags, like the fact that he was a little bit jealous and, liked to start fights and things like that. And we ended up cohabitating together. And it was, everyone talks about narcissistic abuse. I actually didn't really give it a lot of validity until I started to experience it. Within the first year, we'd already had so many violent fights, and I probably had called the police with like a couple of times in that time. And I couldn't understand, especially at that age, at 40, you really feel like you know everything. I couldn't understand why he was just so good at getting me to behave at my worst. It was almost like he was a vampire of my emotions, and he loved the anger, and I would give it to him. Like, in hindsight, I was like a hair trigger. I would give him all the anger and the tears and all of it that he was looking for, but I couldn't understand why he was so good at finding those triggers and hitting every insecurity and why he seemed to have such a deep understanding of it. Come to find out, when he moved in, he had started reading my journals, like my private diaries, my journals, my everything that I wrote on my computer. He had sort of somehow hacked into like files that I had that were stories that I'd written about how I felt about myself, what I had dealt with other people. And so secretly, he would constantly use it against me. And so it was a sort of a mental abuse that was happening on top of the physical abuse, right? So we would find ourselves in, different places where we would get into a fight because he loved to start fights. He loved to get it going and have screaming and yelling and, then get physical. He bit me on my arm one time, like a bite that left marks, but always threatening to leave me in places, right? So that went on, believe it or not, for I would say 3 and a half years. before I started to think that it was something that I didn't have to do anymore. So it took me that long at that age to just be back and forth with this man. Police called. At one point, we went out together and got into one of our usual fights, and we started fighting. Anyone who has ever driven around New York City, we're driving up the West Side Highway, which is the most busy highway. We're fighting. He's grabbing at my hair. I was wearing a wig at the time. He was trying to pull it off of my head, and we're fist fighting each other in the car on the West Side Highway. And I really started to feel like I'm losing my mind. And believe it or not, within that time, because of my desperation, because I was so convinced that the only way I was going to be valuable is if I could get this mission of being a wife and a mother, I started trying to get pregnant with this person. And so I did three separate times. And each time I had a miscarriage at different, stages of the pregnancy. I look back on that now in hindsight, and I feel like, I always say rejection is God's protection. Thank God. But at the time, like, I couldn't even go and see a doctor without getting diagnosed with depression and anxiety because I just was just an emotional mess. And in that time and in that relationship, if you would have asked me, I would have said, it's because I'm in an abusive relationship. Everything that I'm dealing with is because I'm in an abusive relationship. It's because of this person. It's because of what, he was doing to me that I was feeling the way that I was feeling, that I was going through what I was going through. And it seems obvious, right? That would be the case. But we'll find out. When we did finally get to the moment where I just realized that I don't have to do this anymore. It was, one of the times that he threatened to leave me, he actually ended up stranding me in Queens in a neighborhood that I didn't know. Not to mention the fact he was what I would call a wake and baker. So he had ongoing addiction issues. Right. And so we had come from some party. It was a work party that we'd gone to on behalf of whatever he was going on with his job. And we were leaving, and he had to stop, or he decided to stop to visit his dealer because he was buying weed or whatever, and left me in the car. And I'm in a neighborhood I don't know, and it's not a great neighborhood, and I'm by myself. He left me there for about an hour and a half while he was, smoking weed, hanging out, doing whatever. And he came back, and I was obviously upset about it. And we got into a fight. He basically almost ripped my clothes off. We were fighting in the street as he's driving. We get to a gas station. I get out, and I, because I wanted to stop the violence, so I got out. And he did try to insist that I get back in by like trying to physically bring me back into the car. And when I refused, just drove away, calling me all kinds of names. And so there I was, all scratched up, clothes half off, in a pair of flip-flops that I had changed into in the car, and I had to find my way home. And that was the thing that had me say, "What are you doing?" Like, it took, miscarriages, it took all the fights, it took all of that for me to say, "This doesn't work." And so I made my way home eventually. And believe it or not, it took another 2 months for me to realize that with everything that had happened, with everything that I had experienced from him, that none of it was anything that I had to continue to do. And that the only thing, the only recourse for me, because he had moved into my apartment, right? So my name was on the lease. We're not even going to get into how he didn't pay bills. But with everything that we'd gone through, I had to say to myself, this is not going to stop until I stop engaging with it. And something instinctively within me said, just stop. Just stop. Don't fight. Don't let him, what's the word that I'm looking for? Don't let him get you riled up. Just let it go. And I remember I went on a work trip for a weekend. I came back, and what I normally would do, like I came back, his daughters would live with us for half the time, and they were there. There was dishes in the sink that had been there from when I left. Everybody, like just abusing the whole situation. And normally, what I would have done is engaged with him, fought with him, tried to get him to do the right thing, get up and do the dishes, whatever. And then a fight would have ensued. But from that moment on, I couldn't anymore. Like, I was so tired, and I was so of an understanding that here I was in a situation I had no business in, and I could just stop. So I stopped engaging with him. I stopped getting angry. It took about 3 days for him to move out. After all that time of I'm not going anywhere and I'm going to fight you until, it only took that much time. And what I realized after he left was that even though what I was experiencing was this abuse from him, what I was really experiencing was abuse from myself and not understanding that I wasn't, that I was worthy of not having to do it, that I didn't have to be there. And I had listened to so many things that told me, I don't know if you remember Kevin Samuels and like that misogynistic, and my father even, who so wanted me to be in a relationship because he didn't think that I would be whole without one. I had to listen to so many things that told me that not only do I have to endure, but that I would not be valuable unless I could. Right? That was what would make me a woman. And I ended up going to a therapist and a women's healing circle. And, because I was already sort of in personal growth conversations, even what's crazy is that when we were together, we were even in a program called Landmark together, Landmark Education, which is supposed to be around personal growth. And I can remember we even found ways to weaponize that against each other. Side note. But what I realized after that relationship broke down is that the self-worth issue had a genesis of, it came from someplace, right? And I went back to that relationship of my parents that was modeled for me and what I thought it was supposed to be. And I thought it was, oh, I'm just doing what they did. But what I realized in, my healing journey was that I had adopted the relationship with myself that my mother had with herself. I had become with myself exactly how she was with herself. And even though I had told myself at 13 years old, that I'm never going to do all these traditional things. I'm not going down this road. This is not for me. I always say it's like you get on a different train to the same destination. And so what I ended up surviving was the lack of self-worth. What I ended up surviving was that self-relationship that I had adopted from my mother, that I had taken on from my mother. I thought I survived narcissistic abuse. And in a way I did, but I wouldn't even have been there if I hadn't needed to survive the issue with self-worth that came from modeling exactly what my mother showed me. Now, she had her different ways. She could be very critical, but she also could be very supportive. It wasn't like she was without any ability to be able to uplift me and my sisters, but the way that she was with herself was what I picked up. It didn't matter what words she ever said to me. And so, yeah. That's why I decided to do what I do as far as helping high-achieving women heal their relationship with their mother. And I wrote a book about it. It's called I'm Not Mad, But She's Still Crazy. And it's all about healing that relationship with your mother so that you can meet your exceptional match and be able to attract that energy into your life and let go of the desperation.
Desperation creates so much problems, right? You brought up so many interesting points, and I want to start with the emotional abandonment. Audience, we probably haven't dug into this very deeply, but what we learn in the first 7 years of our lives, unless it is actively rewritten, becomes how we show up in the world, right? You spoke about it, that taking on that generational, I say it's trauma because it's not living in our fullness, right? That generational trauma from your mom, the emotional abandonment that you experience from both parents, and that becomes our norm, our status quo without reconciliation of that. And while things might happen post seven, the most formative, the time where we pick up the most information about life in general is that those first 7 years. So I say that to say, audience, if you have children, audience, if you want children, and you want your children to live healthy, fulfilling lives, you got to be conscious of how you show up in the first 7 years, because those narratives become lifelong narratives until a person is almost forced to rewrite them.
Absolutely.
Another thing that you talked about was following tradition. You made a decision quite early on that you were not going to follow tradition because you were aware of how chaotic and toxic tradition was shaped for you. And I think that's interesting because, I mean, it's either we follow what we see or we go against what we see. And if we aren't conscious, if we aren't aware of the toxicity that's woven into what we know as tradition, we often carry that toxicity forward. But the one part that I want to dig into a bit more is the reactive abuse. Now, you mentioned, I don't understand. Like, he just knew how to push my buttons. This is this man that you were with, this narcissist. He knew how to push my buttons. He knew how to trigger me. One of the things that I have learned from my own experience, narcissists, they love to be able to trigger and create a response. I think they are excellent at picking the pieces and piecing together the patterns that will create responses for you. And I myself have found myself in a relationship where I was very reactive, more so than any other relationship that I had been in, because that person very strategically picked those points that he knew I would react to. And they were big reactions, almost out of character reactions, because I was constantly and systematically picked at by this person. So, can you go into it a bit more? Because maybe someone listening doesn't even understand what reactive abuse is.
That's exactly what it is. It's almost like, because it's very, now I look at it in hindsight and I'm like, what were you thinking? But when you're in it, when you're so committed to, what I was intentional about was making it work, right? And being enough for this person to behave better. And when you have that energy, it's very attractive to a narcissist because it's like they have something you want, which is that love and that connection, right? And I don't even know, I'm sure that there are some who consciously know that and manipulate people, especially if they're trying to scam or anything like that. But I think a lot of times people who present with narcissistic personality, I mean, I think we all have a little bit of narcissism in us, right? But I think a lot of times when someone presents with heavy narcissistic traits, I don't even know that they're conscious always of, exactly knowing what it is that you want. They know that energy of wanting. They know that energy of needing love because it's like a beacon to them. Oh, you need me to be nice to you? Let me show you how I can manipulate what, your need, how I can dangle it like a carrot. They talk about like love bombing and things like that. And so that was a lot of what I was experiencing, that like that understanding that I needed something, that I wanted something. But not being able to even help himself, but be adverse to it or use it or be manipulative around it. I don't think he even knew how to do anything different than that. And that's not to excuse his behavior, but that's what I think is often the energy. It's this is what I know to do, is take advantage of your need.
They are great at that. Take advantage of your need and pick and prod until they get the reactions that they desire. And that might be picking and prodding, might be the love bombing, because then they know that they have you under their spell, so to speak, or manipulating situations to get response from you, or just knowing that they have an upper hand because they've created the environment in which they are the ones in control.
And they love being stoic, right? One thing he used to love to do was like have me in a screaming fit while he just, there was just no, it was talkative but unexpressive, right? I started recording our conversations because I thought I was going crazy. from the gaslighting and from the, like, I know that's not what I said. And he just had such a stoicism where he was always just so calm, but like so hurtful at the same time.
Anyone that has been with a narcissist will absolutely relate to what you're talking about here, because I remember when I first heard about narcissism, and there was this reconciliation that, oh wow, that was my father. That was my first thought, right? Oh wow, that is my father. And then along my healing journey was I spent years looking for my father in man. The things that I was looking for, because we will look for our fathers in relationships, and oftentimes we look for the negative and without recognizing it, right? So everybody that I could say, oh my gosh, this guy is just like my daddy, had the very same negative traits as my father did. And having to endure a parent, a narcissistic parent, and then having repeated narcissistic relationships, it really tears you down emotionally, which
Absolutely.
then it's understandable how you then end up in relationships with people who aren't emotionally available or in tune, emotionally in tune or mature, because you're looking for, and you mentioned that emotional abandonment, right? You're looking for what is normal to you. And that relationship with our fathers as women is probably one of the most important relationships in the way that we then form romantic relationships, right? And if it's not kosher, not on the up and up, not healthy, we then see ourselves in these repeated patterns until we're able to identify them and avoid them completely. So you made that decision. I don't have to put up with this. I don't have to engage with this. But what else had to happen for you to then be whole enough, if that's a good term, to enter into healthier relationships?
I love that question because it's interesting, what you're saying about the father-daughter relationship. So I totally agree with you. A big part of ending up in that relationship had to do with the fact that my father, even though he was in the house, he made sure bills were paid. We didn't worry about eating. That emotional abandonment was a catalyst for me thinking that that was love, like that I have to fight for your attention has to be love, right? But also, so much of who my mother was, because my mother, I think, was actually equally, if not more, the narcissist, right? And God rest her soul, she passed in 22, and I have been able to find the good in her. But what she exampled for me was an even bigger part of how I ended up in the same situation, because, like I said, I really mirrored who she was with herself. So what it took was something that I think a lot of us, and I myself, avoided for so long because what the re religion and the church taught me about it was forgiveness. So I, like I said, I went to a women's healing circle after that relationship broke up. And I remember, I had a very intuitive spiritual mentor, and she ran the circle. And I remember having an emotional breakdown about the fact that one of the other women in the circle, who was a good friend of mine, her mom had just passed away. And I remember feeling in my heart jealous that my mom had not. Like I felt like she had a freedom that I didn't have. And that had me have a full-on emotional breakdown. And so having that breakdown had me understand that I had taken on a self-image, a list of trauma responses, a way of being that didn't even belong to me. And that's what sent me on the journey of being able to start to release it and understand what forgiveness actually is. Because I think we're taught to be like Jesus and turn the other cheek. And so it's really hard to look at parents who've traumatized us or people who have hurt us and say, oh, I'll never forgive what they've done. It's really hard to imagine what that could be. But I had the opportunity, I had the blessing of being able to learn what a real forgiveness process is so that I could understand that I get to define myself. Like that was the thing that released me from the feeling that I have to have somebody, the feeling that I'm not a full woman if I don't have children. The thing that released me from all that need and desperation and feeling like I have to prove myself to be valuable to other people and that that's what love is, was the understanding that all of those things that I took on by default, they weren't mine. And the way to release them was to forgive those who gave them to me. Because that wasn't their intention. I look back at my parents and I know that their intention was for me to grow up a happy, healthy person. But how are they going to teach me that if they're not happy, healthy people, right? And so, yeah, that's what when I work with clients, that's the process that we go through. Like, how do we do real forgiveness? Meaning taking responsibility for my own identity, not for what you did, not taking on blame, not making it okay that you did what you did, but taking responsibility for my own identity, my own experience.
I am when I hear forgiveness, I immediately probably
Everybody
tense
does.
up, right?
We all do. We're all
Because
like,
for me, forgiveness in the way that it's presented in society to me is a religious concept, not a therapeutic one. But what I loved about what you said was that reinvention of self, getting to decide who you are outside of what has happened, what has been pushed on you, what you have learned, what you have been conditioned to. I love that as a theory on forgiveness because I really struggle with forgiveness without accountability, forgiveness without ownership. I've always pushed back, even with my own journey. I remember, someone very early after I had been stabbed by my first husband, someone saying, "You should forgive him." And I said, "You want me to forgive the person who wanted me dead? Tell me how that makes sense." I couldn't. I still can't rationalize the religious aspect, the religious this forgiveness, because I
Because it
feel
doesn't
like
work.
people are unable to see the difference, right? But I do believe in self-forgiveness. I do believe in reinvention. And you've listened to the podcast and audience, if you've heard me say this a million times, there are, in my opinion, three phases to accident survival mode. The first one is awareness, self-awareness. The second one is reprogramming. The third part is reinvention. I believe when we get to a point where we are taking radical ownership of ourselves and choosing the life that we want, the persona that we want to present, like making a conscious decision to choose, I think that's when our healing almost amplifies because we are putting down societal expectations from family expectations, conditioning. We are putting that all to the side and giving ourselves an opportunity to choose to thrive in a way that's most aligned with us. And if forgiveness of others is part of that process, so be it. But I think what is most important is being able to forgive ourselves.
I agree with that. I think that the priority is first with ourselves, right? For whatever we chose, whatever we decided based on what we've experienced, right? But also, when we're releasing the expectations of others, it's that ability to say, if I'm releasing the expectations of others, releasing that I have to be what anybody else says that I am, for whatever reason, if it's someone who sexually assaulted me and made me feel as if, I was unworthy of anything but being someone's, something for someone to use. If it was that someone, physically abused me, it's not about being a moral, holy person. What it's about is that I release any expectation that you be any different, right? Because as soon as I can do that, if I can release it, any expectation that you should have been different, that it should have gone differently, that what it was something that either I could have stopped or you could have stopped. All of that expectation that we're putting on it is just because we've been taught that expectation is what causes shift. And so that's why we have expectation, and that's why we are influenced by the expectation of others. We can't let go of their expectation until we let go of our own. That
That's
doesn't.
actually really powerful right there. I mean, like really powerful. Because it changes, it shifts the whole narrative, right? Like that releasing of expectation. And that is essentially that radical acceptance, right? And people hate that word acceptance.
They
But
do.
the way that you just describe that process is accepting, because it's letting go of the expectations, letting go of the preconceived notions that we had about a circumstance, and saying it is what it is. I can accept it is what it is, and I can move forward instead of tying my emotions to this circumstance because it went against the expectations that I had, or it went against the conditioning that I've been accustomed to. That actually is very powerful because it shifts us into acceptance as opposed to, just going along with the process just because.
Exactly. Like, here's a perfect example. So the title of my book, I'm Not Mad, But She's Still Crazy. And the reason I titled it that is because for so long I identified my mother as crazy. So that meant calling her crazy meant that a lot of her behaviors I did not accept. I felt that they were wrong. I had judgments about them. I didn't understand. I mean, she grew up in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. I don't know what she's been through. I had all kinds of things that I had to say about her. And crazy was one of the main things. So as long as I'm calling her crazy, who am I? The daughter of crazy, right? And so out of being the daughter of crazy, what does that mean for me? Right? Something's got to be wrong with me because I came from this woman who I call crazy. I had to release that. I had to release this calling her crazy. And the only way that I could do that was not pretend like we're in a Norman Rockwell painting and that it's always been wonderful and she's so great, but acceptance that, and it's so hard for all of us. Like, it's just a hard thing to do. It's the journey of life. When we get to a point where we can be fully accepting of whoever, however, I guess we reach nirvana. But without the awareness that it's my willingness to release. That whatever went on with her, however she showed up, that my perception of it, my judgment of it, is actually harming me way more than it's harming her. Because as long as I hold on to that something's wrong with her and she was wrong and this shouldn't have happened and all of that, then I have to live under that identity. But as soon as I release it, I get to live under the identity that I choose.
So powerful, so powerful. I have enjoyed this conversation, Candice. So tell us where we can find you online and how you work with clients.
Yeah, sure. So right now, all you got to do, if you want to take a, I have a free masterclass online. You go to bit.ly/masterclass with Candace, and you get a kind of a taste of what I do. It's just a little bit of a breakdown of, the process. And then if you decide you want to work with me after that masterclass, there's a an application form, and we get to get on a consultation. And so I work with people one-on-one. Right now I'm building a group though, because what I'd like to do is just take a group of what I call high achieving elite women, those women who just always are raising the bar higher, no matter how high it gets, they want to raise it a little bit higher, but just haven't been able to find the love and the same kind of energy, the depth that they're looking for in a relationship. And so if you get on a call with me, we can talk about whether working with me one-on-one is more appropriate or being involved in this group is more appropriate. And we go from there.
And how can we find you online?
Go to bit.ly/masterclass or go to candiceharperlovecoach.com.
Okay. So before we wrap it up today, Candice, one key takeaway for the audience to action.
So one key takeaway. I'm prolific, so it's hard to come up with just one. And everyone always says, love yourself. So I would say do a little bit of discovery and exploration, especially if you grew up in religion, around forgiveness. a little exploration around what it can really mean and how you can make it work for you. Because everything's alchemization, right? What I believe about things is how I experience them. I know that a lot of us are closed off around that word. And so just do a little exploration. You're not forced to do anything. You don't have to be nice to anybody you don't want to be nice to, or pretend that any, things didn't happen to you that happened. But just do a little exploration is my takeaway.
Okay. Audience, it's time to explore. Just be open. Just be open to learning something new about forgiveness, about yourself, about healing. Candace, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for coming on Survival Mode Disrupted. Audience, thanks for catching another episode. And as always, I just want to remind you, you were not built to break, but you damn sure were not built to just survive. Disrupt the cycle, reclaim your life, and thrive on your own terms. And I will see you next week. Once again, thank you for joining another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted, hosted by the Survival Mode Disruptor, Letitia. You didn't land here by accident. This conversation, it probably cracked something open on purpose. Because survival mode isn't just a phase, it's a pattern, an identity, a prison masked as strength. But here's the truth: you're not broken. You're just unfinished. So if something stirred in you today, don't ignore it. Don't numb it. Move with it. And I want to once again invite you to join Disrupting Survival Mode, the Facebook community where healing is loud and messy and real. I also want to invite you to buy my book, The Survival Mode Exit Plan, because your breakthrough deserves a blueprint. And if you felt seen today, be sure to share this episode with someone who needs to hear it. Like, subscribe, and drop a review. That's how we amplify the voices that need to be heard. And remember, this isn't about fixing yourself. This is about finding yourself again beneath the rubble. Until next time, choose ease, choose power, choose you. This is Survival Mode Disrupted. Let's keep shaking shit up.